Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is the Ultimate Classic Rock Podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss a single episode. Go and do it right now. There's some awesome guests lined up for the next few weeks, and you don't want to miss any of them. Now, as I said, this is episode 98. We're nearing the 100 mark now, and I've had 25 plus Rock and Roll Hall of Famers on, some real legends on the series so far. So if this is your first listen, then please do hit subscribe or follow, whatever it is on your podcast app, and take a scroll back through some of the fantastic previous episodes and give them a listen. Also, please do check out on YouTube. The channel is growing at a crazy rate, and there's a great community of rock fans on there who get involved in the daily poll and the debates that rages. So please do check out the channel. But for today's show then, it features another very outspoken rock hero, a man whose career has seen him ride the wave of rock stardom and then bottoming out, but then becoming a household name again through TV, radio, reality shows, Broadway, voiceovers, and books as well. I'm talking about the enigmatic Dee Snider from Twisted Sister. Now, he's often in the news for his outspoken views, and I think I managed to keep him on track until near the end, talking about the music business and his career, and boy, does he have so many great stories to tell. He talks about the dynamic in the band and how he felt alienated right from the beginning. We've got stories about Lemmy Kilmister playing iconic festivals like Reading and Donington Monsters of Rock, how he wrote the band's biggest album in 45 minutes, the iconic videos which were at first pushed back by MTV, there's the hits, his bankruptcy, his wife, and whether we're likely to see Twisted Sister back on stage as well. Plus, his new work as an author as well. So much in there for you to listen to and enjoy. So please do enjoy this one. It's a great chat with the charismatic Dee Snider. I'm delighted to be joined by the wonderful Dee Snider. Thank you so much for joining us, Dee.
Thanks for calling me wonderful. I've been called much worse.
We'll not go any further with that line, but we'll start at the very beginning then, because we like to hear about the careers and things like that. And obviously you joined Twisted Sister in 1976, and JJ and Eddie, they were a few years older than you, and I read that you once said that they treated you like a kid. You felt a little bit ostracized at the very beginning, so you felt like you had to prove yourself. So what did you do right at the start? What did you do to kind of prove yourself and make yourself that lead man of the group?
Well, you know, I very much was. I was, 2.5, 3 years younger than Eddie and Jay. They were from Manhattan and the Bronx. I was from Long Island. You know, I was the Rube, and And when I look back on it, I understand. I mean, I remember going to the first time to JJ's apartment and in Manhattan, and Eddie picking up Eddie in the Bronx. A, terrified. B, I was just like jaw drop, like looking around, like mystified. The big city. I was a rube, you know. And they treated me like, I mean, I got in the band because of my voice, but they treated me like that. But I took great offense to it at the time, and I felt very alienated. And it set a tone for the entire time I was in the band. It wasn't until after we broke up and I had time to reflect and look back, and then we reformed, that I was able to patch things up with them and understand where they were coming from, you know? So when I realized that I was on the outside looking in with these guys, they were friends. The drummer at the time we had was also a friend of JJ's from another band. The bass player was from the original lineup of Twisted Sister. When I say original, when the band formed as a bar band, there was a guy in there, Kenny Neal. So it was like these four guys and then older guys and then me, this kid. So I immediately just sort of went into my room and started writing songs. And with ill intent, I was going to show them. That was my whole thing. I would show them that I was worth something. I would show them. And it was with anger and hostility towards my band members that I wrote and wrote and wrote. And I didn't party. I didn't drink. I didn't do drugs. I already had Suzette, my girlfriend. So I just stayed inside and just wrote endlessly until I was just overwhelming, until I got good at it, and I was overwhelming them with material. And they had to take notice, say, oh my God, this guy's actually got something going on.
And did it make a difference to your stage presence as well? I mean, obviously, you're known for your flamboyant stage presence and things like that. Do you feel the need to really push it out big time when you're on stage with them?
Well, I always was very, what's the word? I'm lacking the word. It's too early. It's early in the morning here. For me, it's early. I just woke up. But I was always very active on stage. But I joined a band where JJ was the leader. It was his band. As I said in my memoir, Shut Up and Give Me the Mic, I was never even officially told I was in the band. JJ said, well, we'll see how it works out. And then proceeded to fire the drummer, who I was just talking, because he was about my age. He was another rube from Long Island. So I felt my job was always on the line. And I would just step back after I sang a song and JJ would front the band. He would talk to the crowd and blah, blah, blah. But I was paying attention. I was studying, and slowly I started, you know, inserting myself in the front man conversation because he was the front man. And eventually I just pushed him completely. And again, with malice, I had I was out to take over the band and show all these four guys that Dee Snider was mattered and Dee Snider was important to Twisted Sister. And, you know, ultimately I became like the driving force. But it was very, very deliberate on my part to show them and not the world, show them. And after them, I had to show the world.
Yeah, you certainly did. But let's start with the tri-state area. You guys were huge. You were playing to thousands of people a night, but you just couldn't get that record deal. And obviously, I'm over here in the UK, so I want to touch on the fact that you guys actually did get your first break. Your first label signed you was here in the UK, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did so many demos, and you know, I was writing endlessly, and we made five, count them, five full attempts at every major label and minor label in the United States, five demos, five packages. Five, you put together your photo, five, and we were rejected resoundingly five times by every label. Some labels, like Atlantic, and that's another story. The president went and rejected us on other offs, like ATCO, like labels, because they were looking at us. Go, no, you can't sign them. No, he would actually reach out and say you can't sign them. So, we eventually, out of just desperation, looked over to Europe, and we had a lot of missteps there, but eventually signed with Secret Records, who had one or two bands of note. They had the Exploited. They had the Exploited. That was the band that they had, big band, but they were indie label. And this was a big undertaking for them to bring an American band over to the UK, house them, feed them. We ate a lot, and put them in a studio. And ultimately, I think it did Secret Records in. The late Martin Hooker, who went on for music to Music for Nations and did quite well, but that was his first label attempt, and I think we killed it. I think his intentions were good, but they went under.
Wow. How did you find coming to the UK then? Because I spoke to Pat Travers, who did something similar. He came over to the UK, I think it was mid to late 70s, and he got his break over here as well. But how did you find the era of kind of the early 80s, late 70s when you came over? And because it was a very dark time, wasn't it, the UK at that point?
It was a weird time. It was, it was the earliest days of New Album, and it was the crossover. The punk scene was drawing, not was dying. It was mutating.
Yeah.
So that's where you find a band like Motorhead riding that center right there, being punk enough for the punks and metal enough for the metalheads. I remember the first show we did at the Marquee. The room was packed. But with punks, metalheads, skins, and everybody's looking around going, what? Like, what are you doing here? Because everybody, no, there wasn't a lot of photos of us. Nobody, they'd heard some recorded, some tapes or whatever, the rough cuts. I don't even know if rough cuts was out yet, but they nobody was quite sure what we were. And again, that was that transitional point in the music scene.
Yeah. And you mentioned Motorhead there. I mean, they're obviously huge here in the UK. And Lemmy, he spoke really highly of you guys because you did tour with them. You played with them a few times. What was it like being around Lemmy then? Because obviously he was a larger than life character himself, wasn't he?
Lemmy, I'm getting chills, all right, right now. Because Lemmy, when I think about Lemmy, because my wife has planted something in my head, which is insane, and we'll talk about it. But Lemmy became our savior. We got on a bill at the Wrexham football stadium with Budgie and Tank and a whole bunch of other sign bands, metal bands. Football stadium show is like our first performance in the UK. And because of a cancellation, a relationship my manager had with Motorhead's manager, we wound up special guesting. And we were going to go out on stage for the first time in daylight. And this is 1981, 82, I'm somewhere around there. So, the legends of Canville, Anvil being canned off the stage and bottled off the stage at Reading, of Girl being bottled off the stage. You remember Girl because they wore little makeup. This stuff was led for the slightest just idea that any femininity at all. I think Lips from Anvil wore a fishnet sleevelet and played with a dildo, and that was it. Too gay, that's it. We're bottling you off the stage, so now we're walking out in the daylight for the first time. There was actual conversation, not from me but from my bandmates, about not putting on our costumes and makeup.
Okay.
I mean, our first song was called What You Don't Know Sure Can Hurt You, and I wrote it to be performed in silhouette so the audience couldn't see us. So they would hear us first. And then a third of the way through the song, the lights would come on and go, and this is what we look like. And people go, oh, I didn't expect that. But they were already taken in by the band. Now we were going to walk out in broad daylight. And you'll see, if you can see pictures from that day, Mark the Animal Mendoza with his denim vest over the top of his stage costume, sunglasses on, covering up his eye makeup. But I just like, look, I've had so many fights. I've been down... been wearing, if I was going to take this stuff off, it would have been a long time ago. Lemmy, who I always said, recognized the smell of human feces as he walked past our, because we were shitting our pants. He came in, and this is partially thanks to the late Pete Way, Pete was producing Under the Blade, which hadn't been released yet. And Pete put a call into Lemmy, who was a mate, and said, hey man, these are good guys, take care of them. So, I think, besides sort of sensing that we were terrified to go on before Motorhead, because that was a pretty tough crowd. And Lemmy came in, and I was told, he said, because at that time I didn't speak Lemmy. I just heard, and then someone came in. He said, Jill Massey, she worked with his management. He said, he'll bring the band on. The headliner offering an unknown band to come out before his show, I wouldn't be seen. I'd be like, I mean, that's like, and here arrives the stars of the show. Lemmy, and when we walked down on the stage, I'm telling you, you saw the bottles, you saw the cans, you saw the arms. It was going back like this, and then Lemmy walks out. And then again, he said something in the microphone, which I was told later was, here's a friend of mine from America, give him a listen. And everybody just went like, lowered it a little bit, and they just stood there, and we just went for it. And within minutes, people said, whoa, these Yanks are insane and crazy and whatever they look like, this is amazing. And at the end of that show, one of the most memorable ovations of my career, as we sat in the locker room of the football stadium 10 minutes after we'd gone off, and we hear, and my road manager comes in and goes, listen, because we're all talking and, you know, we're all energized, listen, and you could hear the stadium going, Twisted Sister, Twisted, 10 minutes after we're off the stage. So we're like, whoa. And then Lemmy walked in and said, I brought you on. You bring Motorhead out to me.
Wow.
So, I mean, again, like I'm this punter from the States. I'm a, you know, and now I walk out to introduce I'm getting chills. It was such a moment. And of course, I immediately went to the side of the stage and just headbanging for the whole, then he dedicated America to me. I was like, I'm going to just keep headbanging. But the thing I was gonna say about Lemmy just started showing up at gigs. Announced, sometimes unannounced. He'd come through the front door of the Marquee Club and he'd walk in and come in the back room. Let us get down. He'd bring us on. He'd get up and jam with us spontaneously. And this generosity on his part, like, paved the way for us for acceptance. You go to the Reading Festival where he rejoined Fast Eddie Clark. They were having a heated public press battle over the breakup of Fast Eddie leaving Motorhead. And Avery comes on stage and joins Fast Eddie and Pete Way and Twisted Sister for the finale of It's Only Rock and Roll, But I Like It at Reading, and helps to just cement our relationship with the UK. So I know I'm going rambling on, but this is what your people want to hear. So we're at the memorial and I'm sitting with my wife, and everybody was at the Lemmy Memorial. I say everybody in the, you know, Ozzy was there and Slash and Duff were there and Foo Fighters were there. And I mean, it goes on and on. And then, but beyond that, his shoemaker was there, Pascal Cooper, a family that followed him around Europe. And Lemmy would always invite them backstage because they followed him everywhere. They were there and they all got up and spoke. And my wife is very spiritual. And she leans over to me and says, I think Lemmy was an angel. I said, what? She goes, they say that they sent angels down to earth to guide us on our journey. And I said, I think Lemmy may have been sent down. Listen to these people talking. Everybody has a story where Lemmy affected their life, changed their lives, helped them along the way. Every single one of these people is getting Triple H for the wrestler. Everybody's getting up there. And everybody's got a tale to tell about how Lemmy touched their lives. And I said, so you're telling me that God sent down a biker pirate to guide me on my way? And she said to me, would you have listened to someone with long flowing robes? And yeah. I just looked at her and then I looked, listened to the stories people saying. So I'm not the spiritual guy, but that was Lemmy for Twisted Sister. When I think back on it, he was so there because we had the Under the Blade record. We lost the deal and he stayed with us. When we did the tube, him and Robbo came up and jammed with us on national TV again, helping make it one of those moments. And that's when we got our Atlantic record deal. He was always there when we needed him. And he and I remained friends, you know, for his entire life. And I'm honored to have been one.
Oh, incredible, incredible stories. It's such a legend. It's lovely to hear these sorts of things said about him as well. Just quickly, one more thing relating to the UK, and you touched on a big show there with Budgie and things like that and Motorhead, but you did Monsters of Rock, didn't you, 1983? And again, what an incredible lineup. Whitesnake and Meatloaf and ZZ Top and Dio and Diamond Head. That's a hell of a lineup. I remember speaking to Stephen Pearcy from Rat, and he said that they had a pig's head thrown up on stage when they did their show one year. I mean, what do you remember of your experience with Donington?
I remember I have many memories. Well, first of all, at Reading, we were getting bottled off the stage. We were getting bottled, not off the stage. And I stopped the show and famously called out, and that's a term for meaning invited to fight, 35,000 people, one at a time, on the side of the stage. And the people just started laughing because they were laughing because this Yank's crazy. They could see I was serious. One at a time, line up, let's go. Stop throwing. And at that point, they sort of, you know, said, well, you know what? Let's give these guys a chance. And then, you know, we rocked out, of course. And then Lemmy and Pete Way and Fast Eddie came on stage. Sadly, they're all gone now, those three guys, you know. And we had a moment. So when we got to Donington and we went out on stage, now we have a hit record in the UK. I Am On Me, Kids Are Back. We've got a hit album. So the audience, the majority of the 45,000 people there are really into us. I would say maybe 10% aren't into the band. You know what? 4,500 people can throw a lot of stuff. And those 4,500 people started throwing everything they could get their hands on. So I tried the same stage rap. All right, side stage. But then everybody had heard that one already. So they were like, ah, and they just kept throwing stuff. So I ultimately, invited our fans, the other 35,000 people. I said, where are my friends? And the place, you know, those 35,000 people, hands in the air. I said, if my friend was on stage and someone was throwing stuff at him, I would kick the shit out of him. And if it was too big for me, I'd get a whole bunch of us and we'd pull that guy down and start beating the piss out of him. Well, the next song was like, it was like Altamont out there. I remember fires. I remember just fights all over the place as we're like ripping out and tearing loose, whatever we were doing appropriately. And so that was a moment. And we, they stopped throwing things.
Oh, I love hearing sort of stuff like that. It's brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. Now, obviously, you guys, the image, the videos, it was MTV was a huge part of that era when you came through and you broke again in America big style, didn't you? And like we said, the videos are very famous now. Did you have much involvement in the concept of those and the writing of those or the creating of those?
They were my ideas.
There you go.
I came. So Atlantic Records, who had rejected us so many times, and it was took Phil Carson, who's my manager today. He was the head of Atlantic Records Europe, the man he had signed ABBA, AC/DC, Genesis. He signed a few bands, and it took his weight to challenge the president of Atlantic Records, Doug Morris, who said, "It's on your head, Phil." Wow. When Phil said, "I'm signing the band," and he said, "It's on your head." He says, "On my head, like ABBA, AC/DC, Genesis, yes." And he went down the list. He said, "Sure, okay, it's on my head." And ultimately, he was proven correct. But when we came back to the United States, I won't get into the whole backstory, but they decided, okay, you can't stop rock and roll despite lack of support in America, went on to go gold. And so they said they sort of had no choice but to support us. And it was the early days of MTV, and they brought in a video director, his first time video director, but he had done concert video, Marty Callner, who went on to become one of the biggest rock video guys in the 80s, and who I'm still friends with today, by the way. One of the few business friends I have. And Marty came in and he was cool enough and smart enough to see a young gun who was passionate and he said, "What do you see for this video?" And I told him, I said, "Dad's yelling at the son turns into me, drags the father down the stairs." He said, "Okay, hold it. Let's start writing this down." And he and I constructed the "We're not going to take a video, they want a rock video." And, and which went on to be historic videos. But yeah, it came from my crazy mind because I saw the possibility in video in the earliest stages. And people weren't really doing the sort of a passion play thing where you had the whole acted thing up front first. Matter of fact, the first thing Les Garland from MTV, he was very upset with our video. He said, "This isn't a rock video. This is method acting." And he clipped off the whole front. And started with the father walking in the bedroom and never let that video out of medium rotation because it went on to become this huge phenomenon that other bands like Van Halen, like Motley Crue, everybody started imitating the style, Twisted Sister style of storytelling, a little mini passion play videos.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic stuff. And you mentioned I Wanna Rock. I mean, that's it's a song that transcends popular culture, from the metalheads to the young kids that watch SpongeBob SquarePants. I mean, it really does. Everybody knows it. My 10-year-old knows it, and he sings it. He loves it. But take me back to the concept of that song then. I mean, what do you remember about working on it in the studio and getting it down and getting it on tape? And what did you think when you did have it recorded and sealed? I mean, what did you think? This is it. This is going to be big.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
I've been blessed that I have a faucet of creativity that I turn on and off when I as needed. So when I go to write a book like Fratz, it's a novel, it's available, and I just go in that zone and turn on that faucet and start creating. When I go to write a screenplay, I start creating. I've written musicals, I start creating. When I write songs, I usually work off of I used to keep a list of titles, of song titles for inspiration. And I would have my song titles, and I would get my tape recorder, handheld usually, and I would just look at a song title and get inspiration from the title. That Twisted Sisters, We're Not Gonna Take It. I mean, Stay Hungry album, our biggest selling album. Yeah. I wrote in 45 minutes, essentially wrote the entire record. My wife was going out to this. My son was asleep in the crib. My wife went out to go to the grocery store. And I said, okay, I got a few minutes. I wouldn't say turn on the faucet. I look at it now like that and work on some song ideas. I put a bunch of ideas on tape, and they're like these are little bits and pieces, but usually the whole song, but not every word. And and when she came back after 45 minutes, she said, how's it going? I said, I think I got some good ideas for the new record. And every song from Stay Hungry was on there, except The Price, which I had written in Jimmy Page's bathroom while we were recording You Can't Stop Rock and Roll. But that's another story. So I Wanna Rock was in there, and We're Not Going to Take It was in there. Those two songs. I knew that these were hits. Now, I Wanna Rock, I was talking about writing songs for the band from the early days. JJ manages Twisted Sister now. He's constantly, we're the Tupac Shakur of heavy metal. He keeps coming up with new albums to put out. I'm going, oh my God, where do you find that tape and this tape? And I listen back on some of my early songs. I go, oh, no wonder we didn't get a record deal. Those were terrible, terrible songs, you know? But now, at this point, I put in my time and I was getting pretty good at crafting. And I got in my mind that this is 1983, I'm writing for you, Stay Hungry album, or 82, whatever, because I always wrote it ahead of time. I got in my mind that if I could combine the Iron Maiden gallop with an anthem, with an anthemic sing-along song, and Slade is my inspiration when it comes to anthemic songs. But if I could combine that metallic, like that Maiden, I remember with I Wanna Rock sitting there going, doing the Maiden gallop, and then and all of a sudden I just was off the races, and you know, I got to the end of that, and I stopped the recorder for a second to move on to the next song idea, and I go, well, I think that was pretty good, you know. And then I keep moving. Later on, I'd go through maybe 25-30 ideas that I had recorded in the 45 minutes and sift through, narrow it down to 15-20, and then the band, we demo those, and then the band would vote on which 10 they like best. The band and the crew and management, everybody would vote. And I Want to Rock was in that batch. But that was, it was actually like I got to make, I told Clive Burr when he was in Desperado with me, I said, dude, I said, I got to be honest, man. I Want to Rock. I said, that was your groove, man. It was a Clive Burr Gallup, you know, which Patton applied for, baby. He created that sort of feel, him and Steve for Iron Maiden. That defined the band. You know, poor Clive, he very much felt he didn't get the credit he deserved for his, because his name was enlisted as a songwriter. But he would talk about being in the studio in rehearsals and Steve starting to play that, like the groove for Run to the Hills, and him very creatively coming up with that very unique, that boom boom boom, that Indian drum beat, which sort of defined the song.
Yeah.
And then it becomes Run to the Hills, which is about the American Indians, but it really started with, you know, doom, 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 doom. But that doesn't sound like an Indian thing. Well, you start putting doom, doom, da, doom, doom, da. And you start putting in those drum beat that Clive did. And Clive felt very hurt that he never wasn't really appreciated because, you know, Nico, God love him, great guy, great drummer, basically just continued with Clive. What Iron Maiden defined themselves as in those first three records, that just continue on. And you look where Nico comes from, he wasn't playing that style with Pat Travers. He wasn't playing that style with the bands he was with before. He's a journeyman drummer. But when he joined Maiden, he goes, okay, I got to be a Maiden drummer. Well, that was the Clive Burr groove, man.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I don't want to take things in a dark twist, but I did read as well that you said that losing everything was one of the best things that happened to you. It was a real humbling experience. And I mean, talk us through that a little bit, if you don't mind.
So, you know, I had a huge success in the 80s, and by the late 80s, early 90s, really, but the late 80s, things were starting to, on the downslope, sliding. And by the early 90s, I was broke. And I can't blame management. I can't blame drugs. I can't blame drink. It was me, you know. And what did they say? Well, why? I said, well, the ego that drives you to believe you're going to get there, when you arrive, that same ego won't allow you to believe it's over. And, you know, and so you continue to borrow against future albums, future tours, people advance you money until you get to the point where people stop advancing you. The band breaks up, the music scene changes, and suddenly you're standing there and no one's buying what you're selling, and you got no money, and now you got three kids. So that was a very, very, you know, dark time, and it really brought me down to earth. And you know, I was riding a, I remember in 91, riding a bicycle to a desk job answering phones in an office for a couple hundred dollars a week. People walking in, this is 91, 92. Twisted's heyday was 84, 85, 86. So it's not that long. And people are going, hey, aren't you? And I'm lying. And I go, no, I'm not him. I just look like him. And they go, it's uncanny. And because no one would believe that guy from MTV would be sitting there at a desk answering the phone. You know, but that's how dark and dire things got. But I would say it's the best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me, first of all, it humbled me. It brought me back to earth. I think if I kept on my trajectory, I know I wouldn't be married. By 87, Suzette and I were separated. We've been together 47 years now. And I only had one child, but, you know, we went to couples therapy. We worked through it. But me coming back down to earth and having a one person who, and one of the reasons we really broke up is because she never put up with my rock star bullshit. You know, she was like, you know, when you get to a certain point, nobody says no to you. Yeah. You know, everybody says yes, man. And this is a woman I've known for years now, and she's a tough Brooklyn chick. She wasn't going to yes me to death. She was still the same honest person. And you know, when you're a rock god, you don't want to hear honesty. You want to be worshipped. And Suzette don't play that. So, but I got, you know, but it brought me, made me get back down and start over. And this time around, I was just more appreciative, respectful of people around me, of what it takes to, and the, what is it, the word, the delicacy of success. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I mean, just because you have it, it doesn't mean it's forever, you know? And as I went into radio and TV and movies and acting and voiceover work. I've done really well in all of these things. And I remember, I'd be doing radio interviews and grabbing young, like, you know, happening bands by the collars and going, parlay. They, what, you want to negotiate? No, parlay the success you have into other things, because it's not a guarantee that you're just going to keep stay there. For most of us, it was 3 to 5 years, and then your career dies off. The Aussies are the 0.0001 percenters. A Kiss, that's the rarity. Most have a window or a moment, you know. And some of the bands like Lit, Guster, Biohazard, those guys went on. Lit, the guys in Lit, because, and they've told me, I'm friends with these guys. He says, you made me just, I took the money we were making off of our successful album, and I bought a restaurant, nightclub, which he still has, a great club in Anaheim, California. And Evan Seinfeld went into porn. Okay, that's your thing. But he became very successful producing porn films. We use his money for that. And the guys from Guster went into a whole ecological thing and green thing that his wife and him are very successful. So they've thanked me for sort of warning them. Yeah. There's a cliff up there, and I fell off. You know, everybody says they're going to make it, but nobody tells you that it's not a finish line. We view it as one.
Yeah.
But it's just a point in your career, and now it continues on from there. You know, and nobody ever prepares you for that.
Incredible stuff. And it's so good to hear that you were helping the next generation as well. And they actually took notice and took heed of your advice as well, which was great to hear. Now, obviously, as you said, you went on to be a success in so many other things, TV and radio and Broadway and voiceovers and everything else. And you guys came back as well, and you've played again as Twisted Sister in the past. And you're speaking recently about bands that are still doing it and doing their farewell tours over and over again. Now, you guys have said you're not doing any touring again. That's finished. But have you left the door open perhaps for any kind of one-off gigs or any special shows or anything like that?
No, I can't see doing a 90 or 2 hour set. I can't see singing 18 to 25 songs. It was a famous movie in the 70s, series of movies called Dirty Harry. Yeah. With Clint Eastwood. And one of the famous lines was, a man's got to know his limitations. And that is me. You know, I did a few solo albums after Twisted. Really happy with the last couple albums, especially For the Love of Metal. Just sort of, thanks to Jamie Josta, reinserting me back into the conversation as a metal vocalist and as an important vocalist, and doing some very memorable shows, whether, you know, particularly Bloodstock, which were documented and are for the Love of Metal Live. So I felt I left, you know, on a high note. I was still performing at a pretty good pace. But you got to be true to yourself. I know, you know, neck surgery, throat surgery, shoulder surgery, knee surgery, and more to come if I was going to stay out there on the field, so to speak, especially performing at the level I like to perform at. There's a radio DJ named Eddie Trunk in the States, and he said, you're right, D. He says, you painted yourself in a corner. He says, Alice Cooper was always sort of the slinky, snarling, just sort of walking around the stage and being creepy. And he could do that at 75, or however old he is today. He says, you were always like shot out of the cannon guy, come running out and just thrashing. And he goes, and we expect that. And I would be disappointed if you don't do that. And I said, and I'm disappointed that it hurts when I throw the horns. When I throw horns, I can't throw them straight up and it hurts. I said, it's not supposed to hurt. It's not supposed to hurt. So, you know, so I've been blessed that, like I said, I even though I lost everything, I got everything back. Yeah. And I also have other avenues. I've been doing radio for over 30 years, voiceover over 30 years, acting, writing, you know, now I've got a novel out. So I've opened so many other doors for myself. I'm not like many of my peers who, and this isn't a criticism, but they're one note horns. It's what they do. So they're forced to stay out there. And even though they've gone from arenas down to local club, you know, but they're still out there. We've all seen that. And it's tough to watch sometimes. That documentary on The Suite, Mm-hmm. If you've ever seen that one, was it Brian? It was coming out of a club pub, you know, where he was performing, and it was just tough, you know, that so these are our heroes. These are our heroes. They should always be up there, you know, and yet to see them down there, I don't have to do that. So I don't want people's last memories of me to be, they saw me in a local club and there was a handful of people there. And I was going through the motions because I couldn't sing anymore and I couldn't perform anymore. So I'm blessed that I don't have to do it.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. And moving on, you've mentioned it a couple of times now where you're busy with everything, but you have just brought out your first fictional novel. You've held it up a couple of times. It's called Frats. Go and tell us about it. Spill the beans.
Well, Frats is, it's available, I'm sure, I don't know if it's available in stores in the UK, but I'm sure it could be ordered on Amazon or something like that. And your English-speaking countries, you'll get it. It is not about rock and roll. It's not about me. Although there's an Easter egg hidden in there somewhere that if you can decipher it, you'll see that I am inserted because it's set where I grew up, in the years I grew up, and in a gang situation that existed where I grew up that I lived in. They were called high school fraternities, like college. But they had Greek letters. They had charters with the police. They were fraternities, but they were basically just gangs walking around the school wearing their colors. And they were allowed to because they were legit, because they were fraternities. They weren't gangs. And, I grew up in that environment. I thought that was the way of suburbia. And it wasn't until I started traveling and it would come up in conversation that people all over the world would go, high school fraternity? What is that? And like, you didn't have those? No, we didn't have those. So I would tell them the stories of the brutality and the violence and stuff like that. And I was a big weird guy trying not to get my ass kicked. So I was the observer. I wasn't in one of the frats, but I know about them really, really, really well. And then I wound up becoming friends, good friends, with best friends, with one, the leader of the evil frat. When he, of course, you know, people grow up, they get wiser and smarter, and hopefully they change their lives like my friend did. But so I got a lot of insight into a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. And the story was very rich. So this story is based on actual events. It's an amalgam of all true stories. Virtually everything in the book actually happened, but it's not just to one person. I have Bobby Kovacs is a fictional character who gets transferred into the high school in his senior year, has no idea of the minefield that is Baldwin High School, and the first day of school crosses the wrong person and winds up being just pursued by this fraternity, this gang, and having to protect himself by joining one of the other fraternities, and his whole life goes down to a downward spiral. It's a pretty intense, pretty dark, pretty violent book, but everybody's saying it's a page turner. I've been writing for over 30 years. I promise you people, I'm actually a really good writer. It shocks people, but when everybody else was getting high, I was literally in the dressing room writing. I sat in my room writing. So I've been doing, now it's getting to almost 40 years that I've been writing. So I felt it was time to do a novel, and you will not be disappointed. Money back guaranteed. That is, if you see me on the street and you come up to me and you say, I didn't like the book, I won't punch you in the face. I'll say, okay. And I'll give you back your 25 quid or whatever it is. I don't know.
And as we said, it's called Frats by Dee Snider, and it'll be available on all pretty much online outlets if you can't get it in your local store. So definitely do check that one out. Are you proud of it?
You know what? And then now I'm talking to your listeners, and maybe to you too, you know, and I'm saying, we often, many of us talk about, oh, I'll write that book, or I'm going to write a movie, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. We talk about it, or I'm going to travel, or I'm going to get out of Scotland, and I'm going to move where it's warm. I'm going to Florida. You know, we talk, you know, it's like 1%, 10%, 5%, whatever, who actually follow through and do it. And that, and you got to, when you're writing, you first and foremost have to be writing for yourself because you want to do it. Because there's a better than not chance that it won't go any further than you writing the end, printing it out, sitting on your desk. You're looking at it and going, I did it. There's a great feeling in I did it. I said it, I did it. And you maybe told friends that you were going to do it. And you say, hey, I wrote that book, blah, blah, blah. You know, and you're going to try and get it published, a screenplay. You're going to try and sell it to get it made into a movie. But the ultimate satisfaction is with just, because it takes time. It's a process. And so I say to everybody out there, don't talk about it. Don't be one of those people who talks their whole life. Do it. And you say, well, it's such a big thing. Don't look at it like a finished book. Like, how do I get there? Just start on word one, page one, and just start writing. Just keep chipping at it. And eventually one day, it may be years. I started this, not that I worked on it constantly, but I started it at Frats during COVID. My wife and I have a house in Belize, which used to be British Honduras, right on the beach. And I'm down there and I'm like, you know, got all this free time and going, what am I going to do? I'm going to sit here watching TV. And I was, you know, I was wanting to write that book. So I said, started it then. And, you know, I finished it this past year, you know, chipping away at it, put it down, came back to it because it's a process. But your answer to your question is, yeah, I'm very proud of it, but mostly that I said I would and I did it. I'm glad it's been published. People can buy it. People can read it. People are reading it and loving it. That's the bonus. But yeah, I'm very proud. Just, hey, man, you didn't talk shit. I hate shit talkers, and I pride myself on not being one. Just like with retirement, we're retiring, and people keep saying, "So when's the reunion?" That was 2016. There's no reunion. Oh, and answer your question. No, we're not full set. I've always said, you know, the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame in California inducted us. We gathered. We did three songs together. We had the time of our lives. And it was a moment. And people, we could watch it online. It was great. People see it and go, why don't you guys come back? You were amazing. No, it's done. You know, if some TV show, The Tube, somebody has a, let's remember The Tube 50 years later and bring some of the greatest shows of the, you know, in the history of The Tube. And they asked Twisted Sister, like, you know what? Yeah, we'll go do a song. You know, I mean, that for a moment, that's a moment, that's a song, but getting up on that stage and doing a full set, having that responsibility, it ain't happening because I'm not a shit talker like most of the other people. And by the way, and I want to say to all the people, you know, people get upset when I say, you know, you're mocking, you know, Scorpions, Kiss, Motley, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Okay. But I didn't tell you to retire. As a matter of fact, you don't have to. Your fans don't want you to. Stay forever. Stay forever. Rush stayed until Neil passed, you know. Metallica says, you know, they don't think they're ever going to retire officially, you know, and maybe they'll just stop playing one day or whatever. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but that's fine. Just don't sell me a No More Tour shirt. Just don't sell me a premium ticket. Don't sell me a tour book. Don't sell me that stuff and then change your mind. 3-year farewell tour and we changed our mind because we haven't played everywhere. No, Scorpions, you played everywhere three times. Three times, okay? Time to go. You said you were going. That's bullshit, okay? Just don't announce you're leaving. Stay forever. We love you. We don't want you to leave. Blue Oyster Cult have tour jackets on tour forever. Terrifies me. But that's their statement. We're never retiring. We'll always be playing. God bless you. And I'll never shame them for going out there and keep doing it. They're living what their dream. And there are people coming to see them. God bless them. But they didn't go out there and say, we're signing in blood. This is it. Farewell. 3 years later. Big checks waved in her face. We're back. And now members are aging out and replacing members. That's bullshit. Bullshit.
And there we go. Well, Dee, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you for this last hour or so. I absolutely loved it. Everyone get out and buy Frats and make... are we going to get a follow-up? I didn't ask that one. Is there likely to be a follow-up?
I can see myself writing another book. I wrote my memoirs. And I wrote Frats. I enjoy the process. Right now, I'm gearing up. I've got a movie I wrote called My Enemy's Enemy that I'm supposed to be directing. It just keeps getting pushed back. And then I've just started down the path of writing a new screenplay, not a book, called Speed Demons. And it's about, based on a real story Anyway, but anyway, so I'm always writing. It's my passion now. And mostly I'm going to say we're good time. I still have a few minutes. What I like about writing is it's ageless. It's faceless. It's colorless. It's sexless. And by that, I mean, you know, I've been limited by this, what I have, what I was given to work with. Okay. So, yet when I'm writing a book, I could be a 14-year-old African-American lesbian as long as my words resonate true on the page and the person reading it or acting it believe them. And it doesn't matter that I'm an old white dude, you know, old straight white dude. It all comes down to what's on the page. And if it's so, I just feel this as I get older and, you know, and I try to have some sort of dignity. I feel that the words on the page are something that allow me really great freedom. And that I don't have being in a band or acting for that matter, being the talent on a television show or being on a reality show or whatever crazy shit I'm doing. Oh my God. I'll tell you. So I was roasted a few years ago and, Zach Wilde was there. And, so Zach gets up there, says, D, you're surrounded by friends and family who love you. He says, this isn't a roast. It's an intervention. You got to stop doing reality TV. And at that point, I had done pretty much anything in the States with the word celebrity in front of it. It was a celebrity or turned down, I just really just done way too much reality TV. Writing, it's free. I'm freed and I can do whatever I want. So expect more books, screenplays, articles, things like that from Dee Snider. Don't expect more music. Go back and enjoy the stuff that I did. I love, and by the way, I love you all for wanting more. I love you all for not wanting to see me go. But that's partially because your memories of me are really positive. Yeah. The shows you've seen are great memories. I don't want you to see that show where you frown and you go turn to your friend and go, he used to be much better, or he used to really run around a lot more. I don't want to be there. I don't want you to see that. So just remember me, you know, for the good times.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a great time for me. So thank you so much for your time, Dee. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks. Great talking to you. And again, thanks for working with me on the schedule. I appreciate that.
There you go. The brilliant Dee Snider there. Another fantastic guest with some great stories. I really hope you did enjoy that one. So that's it for me then and this week's show. Thanks again for listening. Make sure to subscribe on your podcast app so you get all the episodes. I've got some great guests lined up to bring you. Plus, leave a 5-star review on the podcast app that you use because it really does make a big difference. It'd be a huge, huge help for me. Thank you so much. But that's it until next week's episode. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.